We,
I'm sure you,
for everybody's information, we have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. We have 13 witnesses signed up. I intend to run until 5 o'clock today and cut it off there, and we'll carry over since we are already going to have a public meeting on February the 10th, which is a Tuesday. And with that, we'll continue on with the witnesses. We have Multnomah County Commissioner Kafoury. And anybody else you want to bring up with you?
Oh, you know, politicians can't speak without their bureaucratic counterparts. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Representative Bellamy. I do apologize for the record. I will be certain that you receive your pop bottle back. I would not steal from the House lounge. Multnomah County is in...
Did you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, I welcomed everyone else. I'm Gretchen Kafoury, Multnomah County Commissioner, and with me today is Gary Smith, who's our mental health director for the county. We're in kind of an...
Yeah. Representative Bellamy.
I can't resist but asking. I'll bet Commissioner Kafoury is rather shocked of the thought of finding me on the House Judiciary Committee. Isn't that correct?
Well, it did set me back, but it's not much more of a shock than finding David Dix here, so... It's all relative. We wanted to come just very briefly and not go through the technical parts of the bill, but to point out for the committee a couple of issues. This year, after now what has been a 6-year experience of downsizing from the Damish Hospital and the Oregon State Hospital, from the early decisions we made about the chronically mentally ill, and Billy was here when we did that, finally, Multnomah County has some clear data, and we've been working closely with the state and realizing what the impact of that has been on the communities. Multnomah County, though we know we aren't always received warmly when we bring this kind of testimony, does have the bulk of these chronically mentally ill citizens. Don Bray was just reassuring me that probably most of the people who would be covered in this new legislation would in fact be in Multnomah County. So I guess a very simple message that we'd like to convey to you today, that we have done finally after all this time enough work to get a better sense of where we stood and what we're able to do with our community programs. By our estimates, we still have 7,000 unserved chronically mentally ill Priority 1 clients in Multnomah County. This is 7,000 people who are not getting, these are not underserved, these are unserved clients. And the reason that this is the top priority with correction space in our legislative package is for the simple reason that it is the most significant problem that our community faces right now, is how to deal with these people. We do support revisions of the mental health statutes. I was here lobbying for the four quadrants in 1983 when another attempt was filed to try to redefine mentally ill, and it's taken a long time and much work has gone into it. We have locally had our task force on the potentially dangerous mentally ill. We support the concepts in expanding. I hope I don't have to turn in my ACLU card for this, but I do support the legislation. Our big terror is the cost. And I think specifically that the $600,000 for the commitment law changes, Representative Kopetsky assures me that that will be modified because the task force had recommended a significantly higher amount. So if this is passed, we just want to be real clear that it will take more money than is currently available, and the trade-offs, we're terribly afraid that expanding, broadening the net without increasing our capacity to treat these mentally ill Priority 1 people that we haven't been able to deal with so far isn't in conflict. So I think that's about as clear as I can make it, that we're just changing the laws without the concomitant commitment of resources isn't going to help us a bit. Gary?
My name is Gary Smith.
Did you have a question?
Sorry?
Well, I was going to wait, but I guess I could ask. Gretchen, you've been around this process for a long time, particularly in the area of human resources. If we don't change the law, we can't help some individuals, even if money became available.
Well, we're saying with the money, we could help these 7,192 people that we know, without any change in the definition, are chronically mentally ill. That's what we're saying to you, that we have identified them. Many of them are ready and willing to get treatment, but we have no resources to do it. Our biggest need right now is residential. As a matter of fact, residential services, the whole.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is we're beginning to hear the undertone that there's a caution that if there's no money, don't change the law, particularly in the area of the commitment. And I mm-hmm. guess my question to you in this area is that if, with or without the money, without the change in the law, there's a great number of people out there that we can't help. And I'm talking about the commitment criterion. So I'm asking your opinion as an individual who has been around all of these areas in the human resources for many years and dealt with them. Should the money and the actual money really be the overall writing criteria as to whether we adopt one of these two bills?
Well, I guess personally that my opinion is yes, it should. Because I simply don't believe, we argued this in 83 too, I don't believe that we can change the criteria and have a broader pool even. Maybe Don is trying to now express to me that many of the people are the same, that he feels the people that would fall under this commitment procedure are people that are already identified in our 7,192 unserved clients. I don't know that for sure, but somehow we have to address the system, and I guess I am saying I don't think that changing the law in a void without a significant amount of resources will put us any further ahead in the whole scheme in dealing with the mentally ill. Maybe Gary has a different opinion, but I...
No, I don't.
And yet, the figure we heard earlier was 1,300
mm-hmm.
rather than your figure of 7,100.
Well, you know, again, we can work through this and try to. Gary, do you want to?
If I could, and I don't know if Don's here, you can tell me if I'm wrong. But my understanding, he used the word universe. The universe we talk about of needful persons in Multnomah County is over 7,000 people. The 1,300 is a statewide figure and represents persons who fit the criteria as defined in this law. That is, with the two hospitalizations in 3 years, our 7,000 people don't always meet that criteria. Obviously, many of them don't. And so that's the problem with hooking anything to commitment, because commitment has demonstrably not treated mentally ill persons in this state. The law does not get that done. So we're looking at a smaller subset of that universe. It's confusing. If you're confused, you're right on target, because it is. I have a couple of comments in addition if you don't have other questions for Gretchen at this point.
Further questions of Gretchen? If not, Gary, introduce yourself.
My name is Gary Smith. I'm director of what's called the Multnomah County Social Services Division. I'm also the mental health director for Multnomah County. My comments will be very brief. I wanted to highlight a few key provisions of the bill in our opinion. And first of all, to say that we believe that House Bill 2324 would clarify and facilitate the civil court process by which allegedly mentally ill persons are committed for treatment. Key provisions are six in our opinion. Expanded criteria currently considered in the commitment of mentally ill persons, first. Second, House Bill 2324 would allow an investigator designated by community mental health director to testify during commitment hearings. Thirdly, the bill would allow previously inadmissible records to be admitted at commitment hearings. Fourthly, the bill would clarify protection from liability for all persons involved in the commitment process, including trial visits and the program initiated police officer hold. I'd like to highlight that particular element because the lack of clarity of liability in the trial visit process currently is hindering our efforts to put persons on trial visit, because our community treatment providers do not appear to be protected from liability. And we'd like to see that piece implemented if nothing else happens, because it's hindering our current efforts. Fifthly, the bill would allow investigators to interview third parties without the consent of allegedly mentally ill persons. And lastly, the bill would establish adequate civil liberties protections at each step of the commitment process, in our opinion. So from a policy perspective, I believe that House Bill 2324 would have a positive impact on Multnomah County, and I'd like to simply echo Gretchen's statements and what I tried to clarify earlier, and that is that commitment in and of itself does not ensure treatment, and we have many people on waiting lists currently without any bill change that could benefit from funding. And I'd hate to see the dollars that are identified in the governor's proposed budget linked inextricably with a bill and with the provisions of the bill.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Bellamy.
I think I've heard you twice kind of infer that commitments to the mental hospital right now don't necessarily relate to cure.
Definitely. We have many people who go to Damish currently from Multnomah County that do not receive treatment in the community, and that's basically a capacity problem. I won't say it's a lack of willingness to be treated or a lack of technology, but simply only 40% of the people are able to be treated because we don't have room at the inn. So commitment in and of itself or going to Damish doesn't have anything to do with ultimate community treatment.
When they come out of the institution.
When they come out of the institution.
In the community.
I guess. But you would very much support the commitment policies that are mm-hmm. in this bill.
Yes.
You're not indicating that when you make that statement, mm-hmm. you almost tell us that we shouldn't be committing anybody. And I don't think that's what you want to say.
But Billy, the treatment for mental illness is a long spectrum, and they may be in Damish for a month, but what that doesn't solve the mental illness problems. They need follow-up treatment, sometimes forever, in the community. And that's what we're saying. It's not to imply that when they're in Damish, they're okay, but they aren't going to be there very long. And that's, you know, like it or not, that's provisions that we in the legislature adopted in 81. They're going to go back to the community, and that's where we feel the system is breaking down. There are problems at getting people into Damish. Don't get me wrong, there's shortfall there too. But when they're back in the community, then we have no capacity to treat them. So what good does it do, at the worst case example, to put somebody down to Damish for a month, and then they're released and they're out in the community and they'll deteriorate with no follow-up care?
Exactly.
So that's why we're saying it isn't effective.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Mr. Chair, I can't help but say that, Gretchen, you're down here asking for money once again. Seems to be a broken record with you.
I asked for the money when I was here.
I know that.
Eldon Rosenthal.
Thank you. I'm Eldon Rosenthal. I'm a lawyer in Portland, Oregon. I just saw this bill yesterday. It was brought to my attention by the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'd like to comment only on Section 6 and subsection 6 and section of Section 31, which is the limitation on liability. It's kind of fortuitous that I'm here. I was supposed to be in trial today. I'd like to tell you about the case I was supposed to try. There aren't enough judges in Multnomah County to try cases when they're scheduled. The case involved the PSRB. It's the model of the conditional release that's in this statute. I'm not kidding. I was supposed to be trying this case today. A man was convicted of armed robbery, found not guilty by reason of insanity, and the PSRB found that he had a chronic mental illness, paranoid schizophrenia, and that he was a danger to the community, and he was put in the state hospital. 18 months later, he was released on conditional release to Providence Hospital in Portland. Providence Hospital flunked him out because he was too ill for their program. He was sent back to the state hospital. A month later, he was conditionally released to a halfway house here in Salem. He was there for a few months and flunked out because he was smoking dope and drinking alcohol. A month later, he was released a third time to the same halfway house. And a few months later, he had what Dr. Bray earlier this afternoon called an episode. He began to sleep. He began to lose weight. He began to act surly. And his parents, his mother, said he wasn't taking his medication on a visit. Nothing was done. He ran away and brutally murdered his mother, 80 stab wounds around the face and neck. A lawsuit is pending against the persons responsible for monitoring this man's condition and for seeing that he was to take his medication. Who is to pay the price for these kinds of mistakes? Are we going to have a reverse lottery? Because that's what it is. If we say we're not going to make people liable when we give them the responsibility for protecting society, the people that pay are the people that aren't honored to be here today and who can't be on the task force committee, the unknown lottery victims of potential violence or other damage. I don't see that this committee should begin to piecemeal take apart our judicial system that's developed for thousands of years regarding fault and responsibility. Now, I know that we've got tort reform legislation pending. I suppose it comes before this very committee under another subcommittee. That is the motherlode issue which should be dealt with there. This is a piecemeal attempt by persons who don't want to face the responsibility, but they apparently want the income from treating these people. I look particularly at subsection 7B, where it says that the superintendent or director of any staff of any facility where the mentally ill person receives treatment during outpatient commitment will be absolutely immune. In other words, the psychiatrists, the directors, the nurses. Theoretically, you could have a very substandard facility doing a very substandard job, not watching for these episodes, which Dr. Bray says we can pick up on if we're looking for, and the damages that can result from that type of negligence would be something that the injured party could not get any compensation for.
Representative Springer. Eldon, do you see that kind of language as somehow immunizing the state or its officials or these individuals if there were an action brought in federal court, or are we just deluding ourselves?
It appears to me that the language here would give total immunity to state officials and to non-state officials. The Tort Claims Act is the place to deal with the question of state officials. I'm not talking to subsections 1 to 5. As I understand it, that is pretty much what the law is. I'm talking to subsections 6 and 7.
Mr. Taylor.
Sir, if I could just give you a hypothetical set of facts, and if you could apply, in your opinion, subsection 6 to it. Let's assume that I take in under section 6 a mentally ill person, a relative, and let's assume that this person is a schizophrenic paranoid. And let's assume that I leave the house for the day and leave him there and leave a hunting rifle there, unlocked and fully loaded. And let's assume that a mailman comes to the door and he uses that rifle. Would that statute preclude me from being sued?
Yes.
Thank you.
Which is, of course, the very point of why I'm here saying that it shouldn't happen. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Nelda Grover. Sure.
Apologize to Representative Hamlin for calling you vice chair. I was reading the wrong judiciary list, so you'll accept my apology, Chairman Hamlin. I'm representing OAMI, the Oregon Alliance of Advocates for the Mentally Ill, and as legislative chair, and I am also legislative chair for Lane County AMI. OAMI is a nonprofit.
And your name?
Oh, I'm sorry, Nancy Terry. My address is 730 East 32nd Avenue, Eugene. OAMI is a nonprofit advocacy group of families and friends of chronically mentally ill persons. We represent that these persons represent the 12 to 1400 that the Mental Health Division estimates are at risk in Oregon. We are affiliated with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and we support House Bill 2324. The movement to modify commitment laws is growing across the country, and we in OAMI would like to see Oregon lead the way. Two of our members, Alice Williamson and I, were privileged to serve on the Task Force on Civil Commitment of Mentally Ill Persons. Over the past 15 to 20 years, there have been substantial changes in the commitment laws and their implementation throughout all the states. The laws have shifted from an orientation in which the primary considerations and criteria for the treatment and care needs of the mentally ill to the one of danger to self or others. The process shifted from the informal proceeding in which the psychiatrist played a determining role in assisting the court decide what was in the best interest of the individual. It changed to an adversarial judicial proceeding with emphasis on due process protection for the person whose commitment is being requested. It is true that many persons have benefited from these changes, but a new set of problems has been created that must be resolved. The ones that are most critical from the viewpoint of many families are, first, the chronically mentally ill persons who need care and treatment and who are unable to obtain it from private or community sources or are unwilling to voluntarily accept treatment, they are denied hospitalization because they are not currently dangerous to themselves or others. That is, even though they are clearly unable to care for themselves, are frequently victimized, may be deteriorating mentally or physically, and the community care system is unable to provide care or treatment. Second, many mentally ill persons are deliberately being shifted into the criminal justice system in order to obtain psychiatric care. Families are often asked to prefer charges of assault, theft, etc., as an alternative to seeking civil commitment. The rationale is that under the criminal procedures, such persons may be released on parole or other condition with the proviso that they remain free only as long as they adhere to the conditions of their release, which includes adherence to a treatment plan. Third, the families of the chronically mentally ill seeking treatment or care for a family member which they are unable to provide and which is not available in the community witness that person denied hospitalization with no satisfactory alternative. Our members here in Oregon can testify to hundreds of horror stories. Mrs. Wood's story sounds like a composite of all of them, but sadly, it is one family story that says it all. For these are reasons, OAMI supports HB 2324, and thank you for the opportunity of presenting our views, and I would like you to hear Mrs. Wood's testimony.
Thank you, Nancy. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Arlene Wood, 10505 Southwest Hawthorne Lane, Portland, Washington County. My husband and I are the parents of a 26-year-old chronically mentally ill son. I support House Bill 2324, particularly that portion pertaining to broadening the criteria for civil commitment, which allows early intervention for a mentally ill person who is in a course of deterioration. The reason for supporting this bill is because of the frustration and helplessness my husband and I have experienced the past 7 years. In the fall of 1979, because of his strange behavior, paranoia, inability to cope with normal routine, and at his request, our son began private psychiatric care. Prior to that time, we felt his home life was happy and average. After several months of psychiatric care, he was diagnosed as being paranoid schizophrenic. He refused medication, further counseling, and would not voluntarily commit himself. The doctor told us that commitment would probably be difficult to obtain and explained the laws and the commitment procedure to us. He also suggested that we start contacting our county mental health department. We made the contact, but found that at this point, they could do nothing because of the commitment laws. Our son continued living at home during 1980. During this time, he could not hold any job longer than 2 weeks because of his inappropriate actions. his condition worsened. His behavior consisted of loud talk, verbal abuse, lack of concentration, incoherent conversation, hypochondria, breaking dishes, throwing food, the belief that we were trying to poison him and stealing his soul, verbally threatening people, talking to his dad through TV, throwing a chair through his bedroom window, and trying to back the car over one of his friends after an argument, and that could go on and on. That's only a few examples. He physically threatened me with a knife in February 1981. We called and then went out to Washington County Mental Health, filled out forms, and after the person in charge felt that we were sincerely afraid, the 3-day police hold was granted. The deputy sheriffs that picked him up were courteous and understanding and took him to Damish State Hospital. The commitment process had begun. The county investigator told us he didn't think there was anything wrong with him, but changed his mind when he ran away from Damish for 24 hours, again picked up at our house. He was placed in a private psychiatric hospital for 21 days, and after refusing treatment, the county scheduled a civil commitment hearing. The judge at that hearing concluded that he should not be committed because he was just a spoiled brat that should be out on his own. The next few months were very frustrating. Being fearful that he would carry out his threats, he could not stay at home. I made many calls to mental health agencies, city and local agencies, trying to find a place for him to live. There was nothing available for a male over 14 years old other than one-night emergency shelters. He stayed with his friends for a short time and then in downtown hotels with our financial support. I would like to add in there that we did try the apartment living, and that was a disaster. During this period of hotel living, he was evicted from many of them because he broke furniture, called the fire department when he thought they were gassing him, and was belligerent with the operators and tenants. He became unkempt and dirty. We again talked with mental health agencies trying to get help. They explained to us that under the present laws, they were unable to act. We were told that because he refused voluntary commitment, the only way to get help would be to abandon our support and make conditions so unlivable for him that he would have to commit a crime. In one 30-day period, he went to hospital emergency wards at least 40 times, believing that he was dying from poison or other reasons. His room and board money was used for taxi rides to the hospitals, and we received many night calls to come and get him. During one of these visits to the University of Oregon Medical Center, his behavior was such that he was sedated and held for an involuntary commitment hearing in Multnomah County, September 1981. At this 2-hour hearing, the judge concluded that there wasn't any doubt in his mind that he was mentally ill and needed help, but under the present law, he could not commit our son. From this time on, his actions became more violent, delusional, and hallucinatory by physically threatening strangers on the street because they looked at him strangely, saying we should both be dead and he was going to kill us, 20-mile taxi rides to open fields to meet the spaceships where they rejuvenated his cells, telling people to leave Portland because it was going to be bombed, and I could go on forever on different examples. Several of his friends and our friends called us during this time saying he was ill and needed medical attention and simply could not understand why we could not get help for him. In December of 1981, a waitress made a remark to him which triggered an outbreak that resulted in his damaging the restaurant, kicking out glass windows in a gallery, and damage in a record store owned by his friend. He was arrested and charged with 3 counts of felony for property damage. We were thankful that it was something that was damaged rather than a person hurt. We did not bail him out. We received a call from city jail asking us to bail him out. He was placed in Rocky Butte Jail, and when we were visiting him once, an attendant said to us, "He doesn't belong here. He should be in a hospital." His defense attorney wanted to see him in a halfway house situation, but found that there were none available. And I would like to say, too, that the defense attorney and his assistant were very, very knowledgeable about mental illness and very understanding. The owners of the damaged property pressed charges, realizing this was the only way to get help for someone who needed it. The trial was in February 1982 in Multnomah County, and a judge ruled him not guilty because of mental defect and sentenced him to Oregon State Hospital for 11 years under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. After attending three PASRB hearings, we feel this is a logical system to protect the individual and society. We are thankful that he's in a hospital where he has food, a warm bed, understanding treatment, and in a situation where he will not be abused or abusing others. I feel very sad for our son and for society having to suffer for his actions due to our inability to obtain help for him sooner. I feel there should be a commitment procedure which would allow help before a crime is committed.
Thank you, Ali.
I am Nelda Grover, and I'll give you my address, Box 813, Scappoose, Oregon.